The meeting will come to order. And our first item of business is, do we have a quorum, I should ask?
We do.
Okay, then I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved, Madam Chair.
The minutes have been moved approval by Representative Dominguez. Is there any discussion?
Hey, you're on top of it.
Any discussion of the minutes? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Okay, the minutes are approved without corrections. We now will go to back to studying Education Finance 101. And we got a late start after our introductions yesterday. So I didn't take a lot of time to introduce our two presenters, but I want to take a minute to do that now because we have members on the committee who may not realize how famous they are. We have this booklet right here that's by House Research that we are so lucky to have and that we can learn from, but it's actually written by Tim Strom. When he goes out and talks about this with groups, he's not bringing a resource, you know, from somebody else. He actually wrote it himself. And then our other publication that we have, this one right here, is actually written by Greg Crowe. And so they are the real McCoys. And often it's discussed that there are only a few people in the state of Minnesota that really understand our education finance system, and I don't know if there are any more than five people, but these are two of those five people. The Senate doesn't have two, as far as I'm aware, like we do, and the governor's office only has one, as far as I'm aware, and so we are very fortunate, and I'm going to turn the show over to them, and we have to learn all this because, and I don't see Representative Mariani here yet, but I wanted to tell this story anyway. Yesterday, he was talking about when he was in kindergarten, his mother told him when he got to school to be sure and be pleasant and agreeable and say yes, even if he didn't understand what was being said to him in English. And so he kept saying yes, remember that story, and then I know Representative Olson was at a funeral, so I'm just kind of repeating it so you can hear it, and Representative Hillstrom had Rules Committee. He said, they kept saying, you know, if the teacher would say, did you do that, and he would always say yes. And so pretty soon he found himself in the corner because the other kids, the little kindergartners, quickly realized if they had done something, they could blame it on him, and he would smile, and the teacher would say, Carlos, did you do that? And he would say, yes. And so then he went to the corner, and the real culprit got off the hook. Well, you know, so he learned he needed to be able to speak English. And in this committee, if you don't learn Education Finance 101, the rest of us will take all your money. So you have to, so you have to learn this real quick. Mr. Strom and Mr. Crowe.
Madam Chair, thank you for your kind words. Greg and I are going to start on page 3.27, where we left off yesterday. We just want to remind you again that these were the two charts. That first one is the one that shows that total change in school district revenue going from $3 billion to over $8 billion on total school district revenue. And that fourth chart showing on an inflation-adjusted basis, showing that money that's actually available in the classroom being relatively flat for the last 20 years or so, and explaining why that's such a disconnect between legislators and school board members when you talk about what good things have happened for education in the last 20-some years. So that sort of brings us back to where we were yesterday, and Mr. Crowe is going to start now on 331, talking about some more specific.
Mr. Strom, first there's a question from Representative Heidgerken. Representative
yes.
Heidgerken.
Madam Chair, and I talked to Tim Strom. If we could go back to 3.316, and I had a question yesterday. I thought probably best explain to the entire committee and ask you a question on the extended time that also figures into the weights.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken. There's one part of our school finance formula, and we'll get to that when we look at the general ed formula, that also keys off the student weighting. When we weight students, yesterday we told you that weighting goes to 1.0 on an ADM or average daily membership basis. It actually can go as high as 1.2, and the portion between 1.0 and 1.2 figures into this formula called extended time revenue, which is the formula that provides summer school primarily for school districts. So a pupil weight can be greater than 1.0 on the ADM weighting, on the average daily membership weighting, but just for purposes of that extended time program. And we'll talk about that more when we get to Section 6 of this presentation.
So, Madam Chair and members, if you'd move to 331, then this is a breakout of data that's collected by the Department of Education based on school district expenditures. And just as a side note, this might be a good place for us to talk a little bit about how we talk about the money districts have. Most of the time when you are preparing your bill, we will give you an idea, if you ask for it, of how that impacts each school district, and we base that on a revenue projection basis. In other words, if you change a formula, we'll show you over the next usually 2 years how the district's revenue will change based on that formula change that you put into law. Sometimes we get asked for expenditure information, or sometimes people interpret that as expenditure information, in other words, how much do districts spend, which isn't quite the same thing, and it can be different for a variety of reasons, including fund balances. A district may increase or decrease its fund balance in a given year, so its expenditures won't look exactly like its revenues. The best information we have and most consistent over time on expenditures comes from the Department of Education, and they do a thing called the School District Financial Profiles. And what they do is, based on districts coding how they spend their money and reporting that to the state, they calculate how much each year districts spend. And so usually that information is lagged, so if you ask us for that, generally it's going to be a couple of years old. So when we're looking at current year data and projections into the future, we're almost always talking about revenue data. If you ask us for past information, depending on when you want to start and what you want to look at, in general we'll give you expenditure information from the Department of School District profiles. So as an idea of what those profiles look like, and this is the most recent year we have, it's the 2004-2005 school year, get a sense of what districts are spending their money on. Just a couple of notes as you look at this chart. You see that you might look at it and think, why are they only spending 45% of their money on instruction? Well, there are other instructional activities that you would think of as instructional in other pieces of the pie. But this gives you a sense of, on the operating side, so not including debt and food service, how districts are spending their general fund money.
Madam Chair, I just would add one other thing. If we have discussions about percentage that are spent on classroom spending, such as the 65 or 70% bills of the last few years, sometimes we'll use a different definition than what you see here as well. So many of these things are very definitional. We use an accounting system in Minnesota called UFARS. The school districts have used that system for more than 30 years. So we have a great deal of detail on these codes, and school districts generally code things the same way. But when we talk as lay people about a category, often we're not being consistent with those UFARS categories. So when people talk about percentages, it's very important to make sure that we understand what we're relating back to. And when we look at the school district profiles, as Mr. Crow just said, that regular instruction on here shows up at 45%, and that's because these other categories, such as career and technical vocational spending, special ed, et cetera, are broken out from that. And usually when we're talking about a classroom spending number, such as the 70% number, those are included within that definition. So a lot of these questions about spending are definitional, and important to keep that in mind when somebody's asking, well, gee, how's my district doing, or what percent are we spending on something, to make sure that we're using the same definition.
And UFARS stands for?
The Uniform Financial Accounting Reporting System.
Oh, okay, Madam Chair and members, then if you would turn to this chart, which is on 332. We've talked a little bit about the pupil information that's on here. The reason we include this is just to give you a sense of how different districts are. It's pretty tough to say what an average district in Minnesota is. We can calculate averages for a lot of things, but most districts don't look like the average. And so, you know, one of the things that we're asked a lot is why everything is so complicated. And one of the reasons everything is so complicated is because districts do look so different. And when you all are trying to deal with the unique situations in individual districts, you sometimes have to come up with formulas that are more complex than simple. So just as an example, we've taken that operating expenditure data that we had the state averages for in the pie chart and given you a sense of what the range is of actual operating expenditures per student in school districts in Minnesota. And this the information in this operating expenditure analysis does include federal funds. Most of the information that we give you will not include federal funds, will not include other fees. It'll mostly be state aid appropriations and local property tax levies. So this does, and you can see from here that the average district, if you look at the 50th percentile, has an operating expenditure number of about $8,000. But from highest to lowest, that can range from under $5,000 to over $18,000. Now, we do have several outliers that as we talk about school districts and what they look like and how they operate, we have some funny school districts that either have really high expenditures. For example, if they're a non-operating district and have a really low pupil count, it'll make their expenditures per pupil look really high. We have some districts that have low expenditures per pupil because they're in cooperative situations. So sometimes in order to get maybe a little bit better sense of the range, we ask you to look at the 5th and the 95th percentile, so as kind of the high and low. So you can see on that chart, that compresses that range from 4,500 to 18,000 down to about 6,500 to 11,000. So that 5th to 95th is kind of an important measure that we'll refer you to every now and then. Kind of on the other side of the coin, when we talked a bit about property tax values earlier in the presentation, we've included this little chart in the middle that says, okay, there's a range of what districts spend. Well, what happens when you look at district property tax value? And again, you can see there's a pretty wide range from $3,000 to $14,000 in adjusted net tax capacity per pupil in that 5th to 95th percentile and a $6,000 median. So again, the average district might have $6,000 of property value, but there's a lot of districts that are pretty far in either direction from that average. And this is also, that's kind of a good number just to keep in your head as we talk down the road about equalizing factors and how we equalize school district formulas when they have an aid and levy mix, because most of our equalized formulas key off of a net tax capacity per pupil equalizing factor. So kind of keep that 6,000, that 5,000 to 8,000 range in the back of your mind when we look at those formulas and you see what's happened to property tax aid and levy mixes in some of those formulas over the years. Then at the bottom, and we talked a bit about this in enrollment, basically the goal here is to show you how the distribution of school districts is a high number of small school districts, a low number of large school districts. So you can see that if you look in the 0 to 1,500 students, those first two lines, those school districts, they make up 40% of the school districts in the state, but only 15% or 18% of the total enrollment in the state. You look at the bottom line, 11% of the districts have enrollment over 5,000. So it's only, you know, a tenth of the districts, but that makes up almost 60% of the total enrollment in the state. So just another way of pointing out that districts are different, and that the average district really isn't, you know, we couldn't really pinpoint one district that's average. And so you, even though you have the same concerns, as you're thinking about how to address those concerns for particular kinds of districts, it's difficult to make that an easy looking formula. So,
Representative Heidgerken.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking at the numbers. I can tell that the charter schools are not in here, are not included, as well as the tribal schools are not included in this as well, right?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair and Representative Heidgerken, that's correct.
Okay.
There are the public schools that are on the whose boundaries, the ones you're familiar with, like Red Lake and Net Lake, mm-hmm. are included, even okay. though those aren't tribal schools per se.
So when Hi, Kirkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we look at the total number of kids again, private schools, homeschoolers, all those are not included in that as well.
Madam,
Mr. Krupp.
Madam Chair, Representative Hi-Kirkin, that's correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garfalo.
Garfalo.
Too long on the floor today, I guess, for me.
It's fixed Vigum 2 years, so I think he's in latitude.
Garfalo.
Do we have an electronic listing of each school district for the operating expenditures per student and adjusted net tax capacity per unit? So it's like every school district in the state. Does that exist already?
Mr. Crum.
Madam Chair, Representative Garfalo, yes, it does. We can provide that to you if you'd like it.
Well, Madam Chair, again, electronically, we've got enough printouts, but would that be something that the Chair would be interested in having each member of the committee have, or not just me? Or
Representative Garfalo, I think that's a very good idea, that everybody would be interested in that, and I'm sure that... Well, let's have a show of hands. How many people would be interested in that? Someone wasn't listening. Do you want to say it again?
It's just a 332. There's a operating expenditures per student based on a school district level. It would just be nice if we get like a master spreadsheet showing all the school districts in the state, showing, and again, I understand it's just the operating. We're not looking at capital. We're not looking at federal expenditures. Just a listing of those for the two variables listed there. If we get an electronic copy, I thought that might be helpful for the committee.
Okay, thank you. And it looked like a majority of people wanted it. So, Representative Olson?
To that chair, to that point, Madam Chair, Representative Grappa, when I've asked for that in the past, I've asked for it to be listed from lowest to highest, and it's easier to sort out where districts are if you get it that way. And if you want to highlight how you would, what form you'd like it, or I don't know if we can get it in a form where we can resort it ourselves.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
Mr. Krupp.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we'll just provide you with the spreadsheet, and then you can. It's pretty easily sortable, and it actually comes out right off the Department of Education's website, so we can either provide you the spreadsheet or the link to the spreadsheet in an email, and you can do it. Do with it what you will.
And the lesson here is that, anytime we have questions and want to sort information, Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow are always happy to help with that. And if members have something that you thought was pretty useful, I think to share it with other members is a nice gesture as well. So thank you. Mr. Crow.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, let's turn to Section 4 then. So we've kind of completed Section 3, the big overview of the general sense of how money is spent and where it goes. We'd like to do a couple of things in the next few sections, and that get you acquainted with where the money goes, specifically as you appropriate it, and get you an idea of the kind of documents that you'll be working with as you put your omnibus appropriations bill together. So we've included a chart at the beginning of Section 4, and this chart is a pie chart that's divided a little more narrowly. Basically, with the exception of family and early childhood, which will be in Representative Slawick's bill, basically the pie pieces you see here reflect, except for referendum, which is part of general ed, but reflect how your bill will be put together. And so as you're putting your bill together, you can see the biggest piece of it's going to be general education and then special education. And so what we've done on the next pages, and this is where we get into what is education excellence, but this is the next pages, 4.2 through 4.5, are spreadsheets that we prepare that on a fairly large level in the case of general education, but on a program level for everything else, show the actual appropriations that you'll have detailed in your omnibus appropriations bill. And there'll be some information on there that's hopefully useful for you as you're putting the bill together. So I'll just walk through a little bit of it and show you how you'll read it and how you'll use it. So for example, on lines 6 through 9, you see basic formula amount. That's a number that will appear in the bill, but it won't be an appropriation, but it's on the spreadsheet to give you a sense of how much is in the basic formula. So for 06 and 07, basically we have the program description in the large column. Then you've got three sets of columns, one for each biennium, the current biennium of 2006 and 2007 that was appropriated for last year and in 2005. Then the middle set of three columns is the upcoming biennium, which is the one you'll be appropriating for in your bill this year, fiscal 2008 and 9. And then the last three columns are fiscal 10 and 11, which we call the tails or the out years. If you hear us refer to out years or tails, we're talking about the impact that your decisions for the 08, 09 biennium have on fiscal 10 and 11. And all those things will be tracked on a spreadsheet like this that you'll see kind of morphing a little bit as we move through the process, because these nine columns will be replicated for every step in the process. You see at the top it says November forecast 2006 is the first column. The next group of nine columns will say governor's recommendations, and probably won't have six and seven unless there are some makeup appropriations, but generally that's not the case. So it'll probably those columns I probably won't even show you, but you'll see governor's recommendation 2008 and 2009, 2010 and 2011. So there'll be a set of columns with governor's recommendation. Then there'll be a set of columns with the House recommendations, those same six or nine columns. Then there'll be a set of columns, six or nine columns, with the Senate recommendations. And finally, once you've finished in, what, August, September? Or are we going to optimistic? May? So once you've finished in May, there'll be a set of conference committee columns that will show you what the final bill looks like. And for all of those columns, there will be columns that will compare governor to forecast, House to forecast, House to governor, Senate to House to forecast to governor. So it just kind of gets wider and wider, and I try and control it so that it's not... so that it all fits on one page, but sometimes the print gets a little small. But try and get you the most relevant information as you're making your decision. So this is kind of the meat of the appropriations bill. If you're not looking at the bill, you just kind of want to know how much money is in there. This is the document you'll be looking for. The other thing I should mention is that...
Mr. Crow, could you also explain, I know there's probably not as backward of people on this committee as when I started, but when I started, I did not really know what fiscal year 2008 stands for, what parameters of the year that was. Could you just explain that?
Sure, Madam Chair. When you see something that doesn't have a dash, in other words, it says fiscal 2006, what's implied is fiscal 2005-2006, which is the last half of 2005 and the first half of 2006. So the fiscal year, state fiscal year, runs from July 1st of one year to June 30th of the next year. So fiscal 2006 is July 30th, 2005, July 1st, 2005, mm-hmm, to June 30th, 2006. And which corresponds to school fiscal years, and if you're thinking about a school year, you can think of it in the same year. So the fiscal 2007 is the fiscal year we're in right now. It corresponds with the 2006-2007 school year. And so the appropriations you make will be for the money the districts start getting next July, but which is used for the school year starting next September. And the other thing I should note is those columns will change to February forecasts when you get a February forecast, which should come out hopefully in February, but doesn't always. And the other reference you'll see sometimes is to base. Base is a technical term that we use to describe kind of what would happen if you didn't make any changes to the funding formulas. And so November forecast, the long phrase is the November forecast base for fiscal 2006, for example. So that's kind of, or for 2008. If you didn't make any changes, if the basic formula stayed the same, this is what would be needed to spend, or needed to be appropriated to fully fund the existing formulas in law. Now they wouldn't, outside of general ed, basically they wouldn't get funded unless you make the appropriations, but that's, you'll see comparisons to base, because in general your target will be a relative to base number. In other words, they'll say this committee has $100 million to spend. Well, what that means is you have $100 million over the base amount to spend. and you can cut something else to have more than $100 million to spend, but that's basically how you think about appropriations as you're kind of going through the process now.
Excuse me, Mr. Crow. I'd just like to take a moment to recognize former Representative Don Ostrom, who's joined us in the audience, and he was here representing the St. Peter Mankato area when I first came to the legislature. And how many of us are here who were here when he was here? Are there just the three of us? Representative Dabney, did you serve with? No. So just and Representative Olson, my classmate. So there's four of us. Welcome. And you're going to be around for a while with your class, in and out. So very good. It's wonderful to have students that are interested in what we're doing. Mr. Crow.
Okay, Madam Chair. Let me just do a quick wrap-up then to orient you to this spreadsheet. All dollars are in thousands, so in all of your appropriations, you'll round to the nearest thousand. So if you see us do that in a bill that looks like it's, you know, got an appropriation of $1,400 and it comes out as $1,000 or $2,000, you know, that's why. We just don't appropriate it then. We don't have enough room on our spreadsheet for all those zeros. So we round everything, or we round everything and take the last three zeros off. So when you look at this, why don't you look at, for example, the biggest appropriation you're going to make is the general education appropriation, and that's on line 14. And I've left, line 11 is the base. And I've left a blank on line 12. You see it says change item. When you make a change, for example, increase the basic formula by 2%, you'll see that on that line, and it'll roll down into the total on line 14, and there'll be an appropriation in the bill on line 14. So for fiscal 2008, there'll be an appropriation. That number that looks like $5 million actually is $5,479,421,000. And there'll be an appropriation of that amount that you'll see in your bill. Each of these lines will tie out to an appropriation. So you have everything in your bill ranging from $5 billion for general education to an appropriation. If you just skip down to line 27, on the other end of the scale, you'll have an appropriation. We have a special appropriation to help operate the Warroad Angle Inlet School because their population is so small that they don't generate enough per pupil aid that we give them $50,000 a year to help keep that school open. So there's a range of appropriations. They'll all show up here. They'll all show up in the bill. The spreadsheet is organized by article. So Article 1 is always general education. And so
Representative Hillstrom.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I didn't really need to interrupt, but my question was, do you have somewhere written where each of these categories are defined so someone who's new to this committee can find out what they mean?
Mr. Cohen, you might want to explain about, because Representative Hillstrom wasn't here yesterday, about the freshman orientation that other members can go to.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we'll get a budget book when the governor's budget comes out that has a detailed page for each of these appropriations, and that's the easiest. That'll be your most complete, exhaustive list of all the appropriations. Obviously, we can answer questions about specific appropriations. There are a couple of guidebooks in your folder from Mr. Strom and I that explain different programs that are in here. And as to the orientation, we'll be on the 23rd. There'll be another training session that was the invitation was to freshmen, but it's open to anyone that hasn't been on the committee or isn't acquainted with school finance and wants to know a little bit more. And I can't remember where it's at. Is it in the House Research Library? So it's up in the House Research Library. And most of the large programs are described pretty well in detail in one of the two books. Mr. Strom's book is a little more exhaustive, including more programs. My book, I take different formulas and try and describe them in a little more detail and give examples of how, if you, a mythical school district, how they would, based on their population, how much money that particular formula would generate for that school district. And for most of the revenue, we do have district by district information that we can provide to you if you're curious on any of these that are going out on a district by district formula, how much individual districts get. We can provide you that information. So just quickly then, each article will have a subtotal. So line 31, for example, is general education. Line 33 is that category of education excellence that we talked a little bit about. You can see in there, the biggest program in there is integration revenue, and there's charter school revenue, tribal revenue, early childhood, some early childhood, all-day kindergarten revenue. That's where the AP and IB programs are, things like that. So each of those bolded sections is an article in the bill. And if we could just go to page 3 of 4, which is page 4-4, that's where you'll see basically the total for what your committee is dealing with. Now, this spreadsheet, it still has some stuff from when early childhood was part of education finance, so you'll see that at the bottom of page 3. But basically on line 173, you'll see a total of how much money you're appropriating. So the base for fiscal year 08-09, the biennium, is $12,794,707,000. So you will appropriate probably that much or more when you actually do your bill. And it will all be detailed in this spreadsheet. And there's more information at the bottom on the next pages about shifts, if you're interested in historical information on shifts. If you have any questions about this, this is one of the things that I put together, and you can sure talk to me about it if you have specific questions.
The good news about the shifts is in the last years, they're all zeros, so they're paid back.
Yes.
Well,
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, where would I find, Mr. Crowe, the special programs category on this?
Mr. Crowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, if you look on, starting on line 63, which is on page 2, you'll see special education.
I see.
That's actually mistitled special programs.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then all of the different types of special education programs are under that. This will also be, we do, actually all the finance committees do these kind of documents just as a, for your general information. If you're interested, they're on the House website. If you're interested in what's happening in a particular bill, environment finance or transportation finance, these type of documents exist for all the finance committees, and they're on the House webpage. Okay, now you kind of know what the spreadsheets look like. Section 5 is the same type of thing, but it's the spreadsheet for school levies. Again, there's a pie chart that kind of details what the levies are for. Unlike on the appropriations spreadsheet, I've included on 5-2.
Excuse me, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at Section 5, community ed now, that's all levy, no state aid.
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Crow.
Representative Pike.
I was looking at Mr. Crow.
Sometimes we just answer for each other, no matter what you call. So.
I don't want to pick on any one individual, Madam Chair, so
I just got to go first now. What was it?
My question.
Community ed programs are a mix of aid and levy. If you look on the aid spreadsheet down on line 138, you see there's a total of about $180 million for a biennium of early childhood appropriations of state aid, and the levies are a total of about $70 million a year, so about $140 million. So it's about 50-50 mix of aid and levy in all of the early childhood programs. Yes,
Representative Heidgerken.
My understanding, and thank you, Madam Chair, that early childhood still runs through community ed, like it's always been, right? Am I also correct in interpreting that Head Start is also run through community ed?
Well,
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, I'm not clear if you're talking about the committee.
No, community ed. I'm looking at Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I maybe shouldn't have put these on here because this will be in the in the early childhood committee. So I don't know if you want to
we'll cover
get into it.
Okay, we had one more question before we get back. Representative Dominguez.
Where would I, thank you, Madam Chair. Where would I find alternative schools in here? Is it listed in here?
Yep.
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez, alternative schools are actually funded in through the general education program. And so they end up showing up as part of that on line 14, that $11 billion of general education aid that we appropriate. There are a lot of calculations that occur behind that $11 billion, and included in that is all the alternative attendance type of things that are happening in school districts.
Representative Dominguez?
And so that big number varies a lot of different things that are happening. But we can get you information about about specific levels of appropriation for specific types of things, if that's something you're interested in.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I didn't see the listing of the schools. That's why I asked about alternative schools. Is there information about that?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez, we have information, total appropriation information or entitlement information. What do we have?
Mr. Strom.
And Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez, there's two kinds of ways that alternative schools are funded. Some of those, like the Minneapolis School District, that's what we call private contract alternatives. And in those cases, the money actually goes through the district. So when we look at a printout, the money is going through the Minneapolis School District, which then contracts with those individual schools and provides the money to them. So it depends on the relationship of the alternative program, whether they're going to show up as a subcategory or not. We can get you a list of who those contract alternative schools are and how much they get. On our usual printouts, most of the time they're done on a district level, not on a school level. And so as a result, because most of the alternative programs are contract alternatives, you'll generally see it run through the district, either if it's an ALC or a private contract alternative. It'll generally, total revenue will be going through the district line on a printout.
Thank you.
Mr. Crow.
Okay, Madam Chair and members. I was just going to point out on, basically if you look on 5.3 to 5.5, that's a spreadsheet similar to the AIDS spreadsheet that shows the tracks again for the biennium, and you see three sets of columns, one pair for each biennium, that tracks each specific levy that that school districts are authorized to make. For clarification purposes, we put in 5-2, which is basically a summary spreadsheet that takes out a lot of the technical adjustments and kind of answers the question Representative Hillstrom had about appropriations, but on the levy side, because a lot of the documentation you get in the budget process isn't as good for levies as it is for appropriations. And so so you can take a look at this, and for example, we've grouped them at the top by voter approved. So the first line, line one, is the debt service levy. That number includes it says net on there because it includes the reduction for debt service equalization aid that's paid by the state. Gives you, so you can see on there kind of how much money is going for any particular levy, which tax base it is, and we have two primary tax bases, adjusted tax capacity, which we've talked about, and referendum market value, which Tim mentioned a little, which is market value not including seasonal property and ag land. And then there's the reference, the statutory reference that gives the districts the authority to make the levy, an indication of whether or not it's equalized, the number of districts affected, and then kind of a short and sweet description of what exactly the levy is.
Representative McFarland.
Madam Chair, does this include voter-approved levies?
Madam Chair and Representative McFarland, it does.
Yes.
And those, we have about a billion. If you look at the on page 5.5, you can see we have about $1.8 billion of total levy for fiscal 2008. And we kind of talk about what levies you give the district authority to make. It's kind of a two-edged sword in the sense that half of those levies, about $1.2 billion of those levies are voter approved. And so obviously you have an impact on districts, for example, on operating referendum side, you can, we have a cap on how much districts can go to their voters to ask for. If you change that cap, it's going to, it has the potential to have an impact on how much levy there is out there. So we track that decision. But obviously, that only happens when the voters actually make the levy. So you know, we have to be mindful of those as you all are making your decisions about what to do on the levy side.
And Madam Chair, if I could add, if you look at the referendum line, which is on line 2 of that page 5.2, and look at the number for pay 07, that's the one that was just certified. We had $528 million of referendum levy. For our budgeting purposes, we're making a guess as to what's going to happen at next fall's elections, and we rely on the Department of Education to make that guess, but we're expecting $120 million of increase in the operating referendum next fall. So that's a very big number, but that's built into your baseline assumptions about what's happening on the levy. So we do track voter-approved levies. We also track, when we're predicting out years, we track a guess of what's likely to happen with voter behavior.
Okay, the only thing, other thing I'd note on these is we don't track these by article. A lot of times we aren't even making changes. We're just leaving levies at baseline. But so this spreadsheet is just divided by fund. The first page is the school district's general fund. If you start on line 96 on the second page, that's school district's debt service fund. So on line 126, you can kind of see the total levies that you're responsible for as a K-12 finance committee at about $1.8 billion in fiscal 08 and $1.9 billion in fiscal 09. And then the balance of it is the community service fund, which is the community ed, the early childhood committee's jurisdiction.
So, Madam Chair, the next section, Section 6, gets your first district-level printout for the day. This is the General Education Revenue Program. You saw in that last chart, the last pie chart, that about 83% of the total aid you're going to be distributing in this committee under the base budget is in this General Education Revenue Program. You can see at the top there, $6.5 billion of general education revenue is what we're expecting for fiscal year 08 under the base budget. If you look at that pie chart on page 6-2, you can see those components, see the relative amounts that each of those components are, and that's where you're going to spend most of your time probably when you're talking about the general ed, is what portion goes on as the basic formula allowance versus what changes you're going to make to LEP funding or transportation funding or sparsity funding, all of those kinds of things. And you can see that fully three-quarters of that general ed program is made up of the basic formula allowance. The next biggest share, another 10%, is made up by the referendum, and then you can see smaller shares for the other kinds of programs. When we do most of our printouts in this committee, we're going to be looking at a committee at a district-level printout, not building-level printout. Most of your funding goes out at the district level, not at the building level. There are some fundings that are calculated at building level. We do have some building-level data. We don't have it for all kinds of variables. And there are about 2,000 school buildings in the state. So if we start looking at a building-level printout, you're going to be looking at 30 or 35 pages of data, whereas if we're looking at a school district and charter school printout, we can usually hold that down to about 10 or 12 pages. So in terms of volume, you'll find that it's a lot easier for us to deal on a district level. We're going to spend some time later talking about the general ed program, but we'll turn to 6.3. We'll just give you a real quick overview of what a baseline general education printout looks like. This is baseline for fiscal year 2009. We can put different kinds of averages. If you look at the top of this one, it's got things broken down by metro and greater Minnesota and also state average. We can put averages on or we can group school districts. Generally speaking, however, people want to see what's happening to their individual districts. So we tend to list those districts. We tend to, as our default, tend to list them in numerical order because that groups them by county, or are there some members of the committee that much prefer them in alphabetical order. We're happy to sort them however you like. So if you want them in alphabetical order or sorted from great to least, we're happy to do that in any way that makes sense to you. It's easy enough to do. This printout shows in the first column the adjusted marginal cost pupil units, or AMCPUs. That's our primary funding count of pupils that were used. Nearly all school finance formulas key off of that number. So that number statewide, 948,077 pupil units, that's our funding pupil count, and that's the one that's going to go against all these funding sources to give you some sense of how much revenue a district's getting. One other thing, we tend to show revenue on a per pupil basis as opposed to total revenue for two reasons. One, you can get more columns on a spreadsheet if you're using smaller numbers, which, as you can see here, we're using up a pretty full page already just to talk about the general ed program. But secondly, and more important, school districts make estimates of pupil counts, and those change over time. And if we talk in total numbers, we're often missing an effect that happens because the district has more or fewer pupils than they're expecting. So nearly always we like to talk about things on a per pupil basis in terms of our funding changes because we have fair certainty about the formula, we have less certainty about where those pupil counts are at. So if you walk across the pupil, the printout from right to left, or from left to right, you can see the columns after AMCPU are your revenue columns. The first of that is the basic formula allowance. And both Greg's gray guidebook and my blue guidebook will give you a lot of information about each of these components of general education revenue. You can see that the formula allowance is the same for all the school districts in the state. So if you refer back to that pie chart on 6.2, 75% of general ed revenue is the same, regardless if your district is Anoka or Minneapolis or Melrose. Wherever you're located, you're going to get the same $4,954 as your basic revenue. The next categories of revenue all vary, and they all vary according to the formulas that you establish in this committee. Representative Heikerton was talking about the extended time column. That's the next one listed. That's essentially the money for summer school and other kinds of extended time and extended year programs. That varies according to the level of service that the districts are providing. As we mentioned earlier, that's funded by looking at the pupil count. When the ADM count gets greater than 1, from 1.0 to 1.2 times a fixed number in statute, and that generates that amount of revenue. You can see the state average on the top there is about $55, and you can look up and down that list and see how that varies by district. The next category is probably the most contentious for this committee. That has to do with compensatory revenue. Compensatory is our revenue is based on free and reduced lunch counts, and it's a concentration formula. This is our proxy variable, and the proxy, essentially what we're getting at here, is trying to get some measure of additional resources needed to bring all kids up to the same level. There's a lot of controversy about free and reduced lunch, whether that's the right measure to use. Other measures that have been suggested are things like test score results, actual performance results. We used to have it keying off a different count. We used to have it keying off the AFPC count prior to a change in the mid-1990s. You can look up and down that list and see that even though the state average is about $333, that column varies quite a bit from district to district.
And we did have a study that the legislators approved last year that was in Representative Dietrich's district, and later on this year we'll hear from them basing compensatory on test scores. So we'll take a look at how that came out and what kind of data they got, because this is definitely an item that we discuss a lot in this committee.
And Madam Chair, compensatory is one of the formulas that's calculated at the site level, not at the district level. Most of these variables are going to be calculated at the district level. That one's calculated at the site level. Again, we're happy to share that information with you, but it is a large printout because there's more than 2,000 school buildings in the state. The next category of revenue is LEP revenue. LEP is the acronym for Limited English Proficiency. This is the revenue that goes to help school districts with their children who don't speak English as a first language. And you can see here the relative amount is the average about $40 per pupil, and again the amounts vary by district depending on the number of children in their district who don't speak English. The next category, T&E, or training and experience revenue, is being phased out, and there's just a very few districts left that get any training and experience revenue. That was a decision made in the mid-1990s to eliminate that. That was money for districts that had a mature teaching staff. At that point in time, there was a lot of concern whether it was driving metro districts essentially to a higher salary schedule and leading to recruiting and other things like that from other districts. The end result is there's just very little money left in that. This printout's for baseline 2009. We're only expecting about $2 million statewide to be spent on that program. The next category of revenue is operating sparsity revenue. And the purpose of operating sparsity revenue is for the geographically small school districts, or rather geographically isolated small pupil count school districts. Again, here you can see relatively small amount of money statewide, only $22 per pupil as the average, but you can see that there's fairly substantial amounts of that go to some of the very geographically isolated school districts. So you can look up and down the list there. There's about 70 districts that qualify for sparsity revenue. The guidebooks discuss how that's calculated, but essentially it measures both the sparsity within the district and the distance to the next nearest school. The next category is transportation sparsity. In 1995, we, in addition to eliminating T&E revenue, we also eliminated our categorical funding formulas for pupil transportation. Instead, we rolled a bunch of money into the basic formula allowance, and then we also created a smaller category of revenue called transportation sparsity revenue. Again, this is based solely on the density of the, or the sparsity of the district. We use kind of a complicated formula to determine it, but basically the fewer kids you serve and the bigger your square area, the more transportation sparsity money you're going to get. And you can look up and down the list there and get some sense for how that varies. The next column is operating capital revenue. This consists of two components, and a fixed dollar amount for equipment purposes, and then another dollar amount for facilities that's scaled by the age of the facilities. This is the first one since the basic formula allowance. You can see the metro average and the average in Greater Minnesota is the same. And if you look down that list, you'll see districts are pretty closely grouped together. So there's some that fall a little below $190, thereabouts is the lowest, and about $220 is the highest. So there's not a lot of range in operating capital money. That money is also reserved. Yeah, I know later on this year you'll have some talks about whether money should be reserved or not. That money is reserved and can only be spent on equipment and facilities purposes. It can't be spent for general operating purposes. You'll get some bills later this session that will be fund transfer bills for individual districts, hoping that they can move some of that money out of the capital account into their unreserved general. The next category of revenue is the singularly most misnamed piece of revenue in your school funding formula, and this is called equity revenue. And even the winners, I think, much less the losers of the revenue under this column, would argue that it probably doesn't have a whole lot to do with equity. A whole series of legislative trade-offs and changes have gone into making this. It's a four-part formula. And you can look up and down that list and see how much the revenue varies by district. Essentially, the way the initial part of the revenue worked is the greater your referendum, the less equity revenue you got. The idea was to measure the gap in total revenue, but it only keys off the referendum. So high referendum districts get small amounts of equity revenue. This last year, we put some additional money in equity revenue. There's a couple of smaller pieces to it as well, and we'll get into that in some detail when you see bills on equity revenue, but you can see there's a great deal of variation there, and there may be some efforts to try and change the measure of equity that we're using this year. The next column of revenue, gifted and talented revenue, is the same for everybody in the state. It's $9 per pupil unit. Then comes a category politely called transition revenue. This really is a supplemental or hold harmless, sometimes referred to as a grandfather. We've had several changes in the school finance system since this system was adopted by the 1987 legislature. Some of those changes make winners and losers, and oftentimes grandfather's been put in to try and help the losers not lose so much. You can look up and down the list there and see the amounts that have been grandfathered in. Those essentially are fixed amounts. There's some variation in those, but essentially from year to year, those are going to be relatively fixed amounts. The next column that's listed is a column that's listed called pension adjustment. In a couple of bad budget years in the 1990s, the legislature was persuaded to make an offset to school district revenues for some cost savings that were achieved in school districts when the contribution rate for the employers was lowered for their contributions to the teacher retirement fund. Those amounts vary by district depending on the amount that they were contributing to the fund at the time and their payroll at the time. You can see that that's a negative. It's essentially an offset to each district's general education revenue. The next column, called options adjustment, adjusts for three different kinds.
Oh, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the pension adjustment, how many years does that go on for?
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, that one will go away in 2020 if we don't do anything else with it. There have been proposals in the House to get rid of it sooner, but 2020 is the year that's scheduled to be eliminated. Yeah, and last year, Madam Chair, it was reduced by about 25%. So it was more in the range of $47 million per year. and last year's legislature reduced that a bit, tied into some other things that were happening. The options adjustment category reflects some of the transfers of money that are happening under the open enrollment and charter school provisions. Essentially, as we mentioned during yesterday's conversation, the money in Minnesota school finance system is based on the number of students that are served by a particular site, but there's a few things where money moves back and forth. One of those adjustments is for transportation of charter school students. Under our statute in Minnesota, charter schools are allowed to require the school district where they're located to transport the resident kids from that district to the charter building. If they do so, there's a revenue offset for a portion of their general education revenue to do that. Also, on the referendum that the voters approved, the aid portion of that is transferred among districts when students open enroll or when they go to a charter school, and that adjustment is in this category as well. So when you see these adjustments listed in this options adjustment category, it's primarily either because of transportation issue with the charter school or with a general education aid adjustment for the referendum. The next column is an official part of referendum of general education by definition, but it's somewhat separate in that it's all the voter-approved money. The operating referendum is listed in that third-to-last column, and you can see, and we're going to talk more about this in another section of this presentation, you can see the state average now is up to $765 estimated for fiscal year 09, and you can look down that list and see the relative variation in referendum. There are some districts with very large referendums, other districts with relatively small or no referendum. Second to last column is the governor's alternative pay program, which is referred to as QCOMP. We currently have, I believe, 34 districts signed up for that program. That's a program that's based on the number of teachers and the sites that are involved in it. So a part of the school district can be participating in the QCOMP program. We don't have a lot of good guessing for how many are going to actually be in that in fiscal year 2009, so the list that's on this printout is those that are currently involved in the program. And then finally, in the last column on the list, we're adding up all of the components of general education revenue and giving you a total general education revenue by district. So this is an example of what we call a baseline printout, a printout that just displays the current situation for you. When we get to some other printouts, you'll see baseline versus alternative. With general education, there's a lot of categories. It's a little bit unwieldy in some ways because just the list, each of the categories picks up the whole page. So when we do alternatives, we're often summing at some level where maybe I'm showing the total revenue or just the change in that particular component.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mrs. Strom, I know we're not supposed to be looking at numbers, just really the framework, but I am curious. So this does reflect the voter levy referendums from this past election, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, those amounts should be included in here. So, for example, if you were to look on page 6.8, the St. Paul School District is District 625, and they passed their referendum and it's shown on an adjusted marginal cost pupil unit basis, which is a slightly different basis than the one than the pupil count that it actually gets computed on. We get the total, and then we divide it back by this number. But you can see there that it's at the 699 level, and prior to the election, it was at about 330 on this type of pupil count. So for those that passed an election this fall, they are showing up in that referendum column. Again, this is for fiscal year 2009. We'll have a lot of elections next fall that will also impact 09. We won't, at this level, even though, as I told you, on the statewide printout, we show a big number for increase, this number won't tie out to that because we don't know which districts to apportion that to.
Thank you.
Representative Faust.
I just want to make sure that I understand this right. This is all money coming from the state except for the third to the last column. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Faust, no, this is a good point to remind us all of. This is a revenue, and some of these components have an aid and levy mix to them. Uh-huh. When we use the word revenue, that's a mix of aid and levy. For the general education program, there are a couple of different levies there, and if you look at the categories those apply to, the middle category listed as operating capital, that's a mix of aid and levy. All of the columns up until then are all aid, but that operating capital is a mix of aid and levy. The transition or supplemental revenue is a mix of aid and levy, and the referendum is a mix of aid and levy. Equity is a mix of aid and levy, and QComp is a mix of aid and levy. So, unfortunately, with the basic general, the general education revenue program, we have four different levies that go with that. They're all what we call equalized. They mix aid and levy depending on the district's tax base per pupil. And usually when we use the term revenue, we mean it could be all aid, it could be all levy, it could be a mix. When we talk about aid, those programs are only state aid, and when we talk about levy, those are only levy. But when we use the term revenue, it could be one, the other, or a mix.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, forgive me if I missed this, but can you tell us the difference between how the operating sparsity is calculated and the transportation sparsity?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, operating sparsity revenue essentially looks, there's two formulas, one is for the elementary school and the other is for the secondary. At the elementary school level, we say if you've got fewer than 400, or fewer than 20 kids per grade, rather, and you're more than 19 miles from the next nearest elementary building, then you get the sparsity. At the secondary level, unfortunately, it's a little bit more complicated, and let me show you a quick picture here that shows what the math is that goes into the calculation. And this, I can lean over Greg if he doesn't mind here.
Zoom in.
Yeah. Pretty detailed math.
Two beautiful districts right next to each other.
Oh, no, I'm writing too big. Okay, we'll zoom out just a little bit here. And on the secondary level, we measure two things. We measure the distance to the next nearest school this way, from building to building. But then we assume the districts are just slightly out of kilter of being a square, and we say, okay, but what if the kid lives over in this corner of the district? Then we've got to measure from here to here. So we actually measure, we've got a square root in this formula because of it. It's kind of a messy formula. But what we're really doing is we're saying, well, pretend the kid's got to go from here to the school and then from there to the next school. So on the secondary sparsity formula, it's a measurement where we're measuring the distance to the next nearest school plus one-half of the square mile area of the school district. And what that one-half of the square mile of the area of the school district is that portion of the hypotenuse there. So the secondary sparsity formula really is keying off of distance. The transportation sparsity formula is really just a measure of kids per square mile. And on that formula, we've got a couple of different indexes in there, but we're really just saying how many kids per square mile do you have, and the fewer you've got, the more transportation sparsity revenue. So transportation sparsity is really, really technically a sparsity formula, just kids divided by square mile area of the district. Operating sparsity depends on the district, the distance between the buildings.
Madam Chair?
Representative Garofalo.
Closer that time.
That's closer.
So when I'm looking at this, I see, for example, the gifted and... Oh, they're leaving. Done.
Oh, the students who are leaving, Representative Ostrom, Representative Garofalo, wanted to comment on the looks on their faces, I think.
No. Actually, I was going to start a fight to make it more interesting. You guys are leaving. Madam Chair, I have nothing to add. Thanks.
He was noticing when square roots were mentioned that was time to go, huh? Mr. Strom.
So, Madam Chair, this is the general education formula. You're going to spend a lot of time with it. Well, most of the printouts you'll see won't be quite this involved because we'll usually be contrasting an alternative. We can put this. We have this information in a series of spreadsheets and in what we call lookup tables. So we can put the information on a single page for your district for each of these variables if you want. So there's a lot of ways we can do it. It's always problematic because it can generate so much paper. So the more you know what you really want to see, the less likely we are to kill a bunch of trees for no purpose. But there's a lot of
jobs.
Yeah.
Waters. That's right.
So that's the general ed program. That's the biggest of the programs you're going to be looking at.
Sure.
Mr. Crum.
Madam Chair and members, we're going to talk just a little bit about special ed. We're not going to focus a lot on the kind of the intricacies of the funding formulas, of which there are a couple that are semi-complicated, and or on the issues around identification. We're going to kind of give you some categories of where students are identified, but we're not going to really get into the issues, some of the issues around identification. So basically we'll start with the pie charts on 7-2, which just talk about the number of students identified in each category in fiscal 05. And these are double counted. And they're multiple counted.
Yeah.
So these are multiple counted. If there's a student with multiple identifications, they're counted multiple times in the pie chart. And that you've got the same information in a bar chart form on 7-3, so you can see the actual numbers of students or the number of identifications that exist in the state right now and their relative magnitude to each other. One note, as we talk about identification, we often get the question of whether there's an incentive built into identification because of the fact that we pay for special education. But right now, we're as we'll show later, the state doesn't come close to funding the cost of those students. So basically, every additional student that's identified, additional services are required, and less money is at a less than full reimbursement by the state. The chart on 7-4 is kind of a percentage of students with disabilities relative to the total student population. And then 7-5 is a percentage change by category. So you can kind of get a sense of where the growing identification is, and in some cases where there is fewer identifications between. And this is in a 10-year comparison between fiscal 95 and fiscal 05. We move away from identification to funding. The chart on page 7-6 gives you an idea of where we've been at in terms of special education funding. Couple things to note. There was a levy for special education up until 1999 when it was finally phased out. So at this point, from 2000 and on, all the special education funding is in these two categories is state aid. You can also see the dark bar is the excess cost program. That was a program that was instituted in the late 90s to try and, given that we weren't fully funding special ed costs, to try and give some additional funding to districts that had significant unfunded special education costs. And so there was this extra category created, and you can see how it has grown since 1998. One thing to note on the trend, obviously, for a period of time, there was pretty good growth in funding, and that stopped. What happened was that in the 2003 session, up until that fiscal year, the state had built in growth factors in the formulas. Special education is a capped program. In other words, we set a maximum amount of money that will go out and then prorated and allocated across all school districts. That cap was built, a growth factor was built into that cap so that every year there was additional money. That cap has since eliminated, and you see funding actually went down between 2003 and 2005 because of that, and that's because an additional part of the cap was an adjustment for pupil growth. And since number of pupils was declining, the actual special ed cap went down during that time. And then during last session, we added a greater than on the cap, so that if pupils decline, the cap stays flat rather than going down. But if pupils grow, then the cap will go up. So then you can see that funding is basically flat for 2006 and later.
Yep, Representative.
Madam Chair, so regarding the cap and the growth factor, is this based off of statewide enrollment, or do we break it down to individual school districts and adjust for that?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, if I'm Garofalo, it's statewide enrollment.
Mm-hmm. So Madam Chair, just to clarify then, so even though enrollment might be flat or declining for a majority of school districts, for those districts where they are experiencing a large increase in student population and special ed students, the cap is still applied to them. It's not distributed on a percentage basis.
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the cap is a statewide cap. And so basically, if you think of it as a solid piece of pie, if a district is growing and its number of special ed students is growing, its pie slice gets bigger. So basically, everybody else gets less, or the districts that are declining get less. Everything that happens in special ed kind of happens within that pie. So unless that cap goes up, you're just redistributing money.
It's almost as tough as Garofalo.
Okay,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Crow.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, you will often hear about the 40% full funding of special education promise or guarantee or whatever you characterize it as from the federal government. This is a table prepared by the Department of Education to basically show what the state is receiving from the federal government and has over time. So if you look at year 06-07, you can see how they calculate that. But the number that people most ask us is where are we at relative to that 40%, and that's the second to the last column, the 17% number. So that's kind of based on how they calculate that 40%, which probably isn't how you think about it, but we don't want to get into that right now. But based on how they calculate that 40%, the state is getting about 17%. So the columns on each side of that, to the left is how much do we get, $175 million, and the column to the right is how much more would we get if we actually got the 40% level. So there would be an additional $230 million. So if you look at this chart, that there'd be an additional this much, so an additional third up on top. It would be about a 30% increase in what the state is allocating now. Now that last chart didn't include federal funds, the 175 that's in there right now, but you get the idea of how much more the state would have if the federal government provided that 40%. The next and the rest of this section is a discussion of what we call the special education cross subsidy. What this is a calculation by the Department of Education that basically tries to figure out how much money districts are taking out of the general fund to pay for the special ed costs that are legitimate special ed costs that are not funded by the special education formulas or by the federal money that we get. 7-8 is a chart with historical data on it, and there are if you go from left to right, you go from fiscal 99 to fiscal 2004, how much is the cross subsidy? So section 1, if we go from top to bottom, then shows how much special ed expenditures there were. So just looking at the first column, in fiscal 1999, there were $917 million of special education expenditures. Then section 2 says how much categorical revenue is there. And that includes state, federal, and other tuition and third-party billings. So of that $917 million, $546 million is generated through our funding formulas. So you might say, well, that's the cross-subsidy. Well, it's not exactly the cross-subsidy because that's what we call, then, if you go down to Section 4, I'm going to skip over 3, that's what we call the gross cross-subsidy, which is total expenditures minus total revenue. But what we know is that outside of special education, those students are generating revenue for the schools as well. So that's what's calculated in 3A and B. And basically what 3A is, if you look at 3A and B are is the general education money that those students generate, education money that those students generate. 3A is all special education students generate for this year $111 million. 3B is students who are served more than 60% time outside of the regular classroom. So if you're thinking about it, then you get the net on B and C, the net cross subsidy and adjusted net cross subsidy. Well, which is the better number? What this is trying to get at is how much do schools have to spend on kids how much the schools take out of their general ed budget. And so if those students, those special ed students, are served more than 60% of the time outside of the regular classroom, then that extra cost, that's an extra expenditure for the district. Where if the student is served less than that, in other words, more in the general education classroom, then not necessarily that you're dealing with those kids full-time in a special ed classroom. So some of that general ed revenue should be applied to the general ed cost that student is generating, because they're in a regular classroom and they're part, so you've got regular expenses and so on. So we have two calculations of the net cross subsidy, and those are on 4B and 4C.
Yeah, and I'd just say neither Mr. Crow nor myself feel that either of those is necessarily the right number. They're two different numbers. There are reasons to like either the adjusted or the net cross subsidy. So when people say, well, which one's the real number? Well, they're both, they tell a slightly different story, and they're both meaningful. But so if you look at those numbers, as Mr. Crow was saying, that for 1999, that gross cross subsidy, $371 million, that's the biggest of all numbers you could use. The net cross subsidy is the smallest at $260 million. And this adjusted net says, well, really some of their general ed money, but not all of it, could be used for filling that gap, leaves you at about $322 million. If you require us to give you just one, the one at the end of the printout's often the easiest to see, and that adjusted net cross subsidy is probably the one I'd refer you to if you needed just one number. But there are some reasons why the net may also be a helpful number. But so if you were to use that one in 1999, you'd say that there was a $322 million cross subsidy. That is $322 million of unfunded special ed costs that had to come from the general ed program. And if you go all the way over to the right on that single sheet on page 7.8, $377 million is the number for fiscal year 2004.
And one thing to note, if you look back on this table, fiscal 2004 was kind of the last year of growth in state special education aid. So over the last couple of years, we're now in fiscal 2007, we've been experiencing growth in Section 1 of expenditures of about 8% per year of special ed expenditures, and no increase in Section 2 in the state appropriations for special education. So that number is going to, once we are able to update this data, that number will probably grow fairly significantly, fairly rapidly.
Representative Van Zelt has a question.
Madam Chair, gentlemen, there are categories of special education challenges facing students. Are the state dollars adjusted based on category?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Van Zelt, no. In Minnesota, we don't fund on a pupil basis for special education or a category base. We reimburse cost of the special education instructors. So we don't care if the student is classified as autistic or EBD or learning disabled. It's whatever the salary cost for the employee that's serving that student is. So it's not some states have a weighting where they say if you have a certain kind of disability, you get X amount more. In Minnesota, we don't use that system. We have a cost reimbursement formula.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, then 7.9 is another one of those district by district printouts, and basically it mirrors the information on that was on the previous chart on a statewide basis, but it's as I said, on a district by district basis. So I'll just skim across it. Column A is the adjusted pupil unit, which is the headcount of pupils. B is the group of one that was in group one on the first page, which is special education expenditures by the district. So Aiken, for example, had $1.2 million of special education expenditures. Then they received $640,000 of state categorical revenue from the state and federal governments. So the big number, the gross cross subsidy, is the difference between those two numbers, $532,000. And then column E is that is that big number of, if you applied all the general education revenue that all the special ed students generated, that's $200,000, you get that net cross subsidy of $330,000, which is the smallest number that could be potentially described as the cross subsidy. But H is kind of the is what we call the adjusted general revenue for special ed. In other words, the kids that are less than 60% time, to get the net adjusted, the adjusted net cross subsidy of $491,000, and that's the same. That column is equivalent to the last bottom line on the previous chart that kind of says, okay, you can use some of that general education money for, that those special ed kids generate for special ed purposes, but because there are some students receiving services in regular classrooms, you can't use all of it. And kind of the middle ground between the gross and the net cross subsidy, the adjusted cross subsidy. So you can look down that list. You can see on a per pupil basis in column J or on a total basis what an individual school district is looking at in terms of cross subsidy of special education expenditures.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think we're getting close on time here. Just very briefly, we can talk about, we probably won't even get into the printouts on the facilities funding and the debt service. Mr. Tro will go through a couple pages on facilities funding for you, and then we'll just very briefly look at the printout, and then we'll go through a little bit on the referendum, and just very briefly there look at the printout too, but we'll come back in large part to those two areas.
Madam Chair and members, I'm just going to jump, just point to 8.2 and 8.4. So if you look at 8.2, this is what's happening in the state in terms of total school district debt service in all of the districts that pass voter-approved building projects. We've gone from about $300 million, doubled that to in 97 to about $600 million in the current fiscal year, and we're projecting a continued growth up over $700 million by fiscal year 2009. You see there are two parts to the debt, to school district debt service. The bulk of it is the light colored bar where they levy to pay those costs. The little dark bar at the top is the state aid that we pay on our equalized debt service formula. We have debt service is one of the formulas that's equalized. We set, it's actually a multiple tier equalization where we have two equalizing factors, and we say for the first 15% of, now let's not even get into that much detail. For the first part, districts pay it all. In other words, if they go out and they make some pass some referendum debt, they have to pay for it themselves, all with local levy. The second part we equalize at $3,200 per pupil of net tax capacity, which we remember is about half of what average net tax capacity is. And then if they have a lot of debt, we equalize it at a higher level at $8,000 per pupil of tax capacity. And so what's happening over time is property value is growing, and that's why we point you to the chart on 8.4. As property, and that two-tier or three-tier, depending on how you count, we call it two-tier, but it's really three tiers. That two-tier equalizing formula was instituted and starting in fiscal 2003 and 4, and you can see where there's a little bit of a jump in this is the percent of debt service that's paid with state aid. So you can see the general trend is downward as property values go up, and we have fixed equalizing factors, less and less of the money that the state promised or that the district expected based on their property value when they passed their referendum gets delivered to the districts because of growing property value. And we're actually getting to the point where for fiscal 2009 we're projecting that less than 2% of all debt service will be paid through state aid through the equalizing formulas if the equalizing factors stay fixed at the level that they're at now. And on a dollar basis it's about $5 million by 09, about $10 million by 09, and you see that on 8.3. So you can see we've dropped from about 30 in 97 to about $10 million in 09 projected. And
all
there's
those,
a printout in
all
here.
All those bonds that were passed and the voters were given their little charts, how much they had to pay per their house, doesn't quite hold true with things like this.
Well, and Madam Chair, as values increase, those boxes are still accurate if their house were valued at the same level. But, you know, 10 years ago, their house may have been valued at $100,000, and now it may be valued at $250,000. So that's part of the change that's going on there. But I think the key thing to hear is this is a program where in 1997, 10% of the total bonds were being repaid with state aid, and in 2009, we're expecting it to be about 1.5%. The next pages, and we're not even going to really go into this, there's just a printout on the debt service there that shows, well, what about if we raise that first tier from $3,200 to $8,000, and you can see how a change like that would affect individual districts. Then, real quickly, on equalization printouts, if you go to Section 9B, starting on page 9.3, this is on the referendum revenue, and there's a couple real quick charts here for you that show what's happened to the referendum revenue over time. This is an A-plus levy chart on 9.3, and you can see back in 1980 when the referendums were first authorized, about $17 million a referendum. They climbed very dramatically up until 2001. Part of the school finance reforms that year were to take $415 away from everybody's referendum, roll it into the basic formula allowance, and you can see a big jump between fiscal 2002 down to fiscal 2003, but then they've grown very quickly since then. So in terms of millions of dollars, in 2003 we had about $300 million of referendum. That's more than doubled in the five-year period to 2009, where you see over $600 million of referendum revenues expected. If you look at that same chart on a per-pupil basis, which is on 9.4, it's very much the same pattern. Slightly less aid going in those last years now. That aid levy formula has been adjusted some, but you can see it's about 20 in the last couple of years here, about 20% aid, 80% levy. Then as a percent of a total school district's revenue on page 9.5, you can see how that's changed again. We've got that one-year blip in 2003 where we really reduced referendums a lot, but they climbed back up pretty quick for a whole variety of reasons. The next chart on 9.6 shows the number of districts, the percent of districts with a referendum. We're up to about 88% of the school districts having a referendum now. The next page we won't talk too much about, but there's just some historical information about election results. You can see how many referendums were tried in each of the years since 1991. You can see this, if you look at the bottom number before the footnotes start, in 2006 there were 84 elections this year with only 33 of those passing, highest failure rate we've ever had on referendums, I think several. Yeah, 2001 was the year after the reforms where a bunch of referendum was eliminated. You could see there were 207 elections that year. And we'll go into this in more detail when we talk about referendums. Then just a few boxes, a few graphs to give you some sense of how these referendums are distributed amongst school districts. Small districts and the medium to large districts have the highest amount of referendum per student. Those districts with 1 to 2,000 students have the lowest amount. If you look at the aid amount, the aid goes way down as the districts get larger. This doesn't key off pupil size, though. This is just a function that people in the small districts are also in relatively property poor school districts for referendum purposes. When you look at the average levy, you can see it's just the inverse of the aid chart. And then when you go to 9.11, if you look at metro, non-metro, significant difference there, about $800 of referendum per student in the metro area and about $630, I think, in the non-metro area. The last two charts on 9.12 show starting on 9.12, shows that most of the referendum aid goes to Greater Minnesota. That's again, based on tax base, those districts are more property poor. The counter to that, 9.13, most of that levy is in the metro area. And when you look at tax rate, on an average tax rate on a $200,000 property, you can see that about $290 in the metro area is the average amount of referendum tax being paid. In Greater Minnesota, about $260, so not real far apart on the rate. And then again here on the printout, an alternative that would increase that first tier of equalization from $476,000 to $650,000. And you could see how a program like that would affect individual districts.
Thank you very much. Very nice job. Members, you no longer have to keep these
study guides in your folder. You can take them with you if you want to memorize them even more. Next week, we will be starting on Tuesday looking at the topic of the achievement gap. Have a nice weekend. Meeting's adjourned.